Support for the National Writers Series comes from Jonathan and Marissa Wege, supporting good things that need to happen now.
Welcome to the National Writers Series from Interlaken Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. David Ebershoff's novel, The Danish Girl, is about a Danish man named Einar Wegner, who becomes one of the first people to seek out gender-altering surgery to become a woman named Lily Elba. The book was made into a movie in 2015. David talks this hour with writer David Griffith, who asked Ebershoff if he knew when he was writing The Danish Girl that it would interest the public so widely. This event was recorded at the Traverse City Opera House in May 2016.
The short answer is no, because I was a young writer and I had no sense of what I could do. Or what I wanted to do, but when I encountered the story of Lily Elba for the first time, who's Eddie Redmayne plays Lily in The Danish Girl, I was really struck by elements of her story. Lily was a transgender woman decades before the word transgender existed, and she had to forge a path that did not exist. And I was really curious about the kind of strength and courage it must have taken for her to recognize who she was, tell her wife, her spouse, who she was, and then tell the world who she was. And so that's how I got into it. I did wonder, would anyone want to read this? Is it a story that others might find compelling? And then I somehow managed to give myself a piece of good advice that I give my students to this day, which is write the book you want to read. And I said, even if no one else wants to read this, I would want to read it. I would want to tell it. And so I plunged into it, having no idea what would happen. I really didn't even think it would get published. I was that uncertain, not because of the subject matter, I just really didn't know what was ahead for me. I didn't know if there was a world for the stories that I wanted to tell.
Right, and so when you started working on the book, I believe this was in the late 90s, I think you said 1996 was the first time that you traveled to do research?
Yeah, the first time I went to Denmark was 1997, I knew I needed to go there for the story. Denmark plays, it's not just the setting, but it really informs where they come from and the cultural context that Lily came out of. And at the time, I didn't tell anyone I was working on this book. No one in the world knew what I was thinking about. And I was working full time and I saved up some money and I saved up my vacation time, and I told my boss I was going to Denmark on vacation for 2 weeks, and he said, why there? And I didn't know what to say, and I said, I'm looking for a friend. And that's what I was doing in many ways, and although I had never thought of it in those terms, and I got to Copenhagen, and one of the first places I went was a place called the Royal Academy of Art, which is an old art school. It's been there a couple hundred years. These two characters are artists, and this is where they studied art, where they met, where they fell in love at the beginning of the 20th century, and the buildings still are very much as they are from their time today, or in the 90s, so I went there. I wanted to be where they had been. I wanted to sit in the classrooms they had sat in. I wanted to stand in the studios where they had painted and seen how the light falls, the light that they had worked in. That all these details are really important to me to kind of understand what a character comes out of. And it was on that trip that I first began to think perhaps I could write this story.
I wanted to pick up on something you said a minute ago, and you had said this, I think, yesterday too, that you were looking for a friend.
Yeah.
And you had, last night at the fundraiser, talked about, very movingly, because it matches up very much with my own experience with libraries as a young boy, going to the library every day, reading voraciously, But for you, you had said that you were at that moment, 12 or 13, beginning to think that perhaps you were gay, and that you were devouring books, finding any books that you could by gay authors that had gay characters, and looking for connection, I suppose.
Yeah.
If that's not putting words in your mouth.
No, that's absolutely right. When I was about 13, or 14, I think it was 14 at the time. It was when I realized I was gay, and this was in the 80s in Southern California, and I didn't know any gay people. I didn't know how to know gay people or anything, and this was also a time when gay life, as depicted in the media, was not a positive story, and it wasn't something that a young gay person really looked forward to. It was a story of gay people being denigrated in the media, and obviously AIDS was part of the story, so there was a devastating element to it. And I withdrew socially, as many young people do when they're struggling through some central internal crisis. And for one summer, I went to the library, the Pasadena Public Library, every single day. I rode my bicycle there and read every book that I could find by a gay author that had a gay subject or a gay character or gay themes in some way. And like, literally like a bookworm, just like chomped my way through these texts and saw different versions of lives that began to show me something that I wasn't seeing anywhere else and began to tell me some things about myself. The other thing that it told me about myself is that the effect that these books were having on me, I wanted to have that effect on other people. And I wanted to see if I could try. And so it was then that I really started putting my pen to paper and started telling stories that were maybe about myself, maybe not, and just really trying to shape some kind of experience or ideas through narrative. And so it does connect to this idea of looking for a friend, because that summer I found friends in books, and I found friends in characters who were not real but were realer to me than anyone else at that moment, or what I needed.
Or what you were seeing in the media,
which
are constructions, mm-hmm. essentially.
Yeah, they were definitely.
Stereotypes. So writing a character like Lily, mm-hmm. I know that there is material that you could draw from, letters and notes that she had made,
yes.
To form an autobiography, and of course that was source material for you. But then the decision to write a novel, well, maybe it wasn't a decision, maybe you could talk about that if you had ever.
Sure.
But the decision to write that as a novel, not as a biography, and inhabit her perspective and her point of view. Could you talk about any of the obstacles or the difficulties that you walked into the writing process with? Or maybe you didn't, I don't know.
yes, I did. Okay. For me, I love fiction that takes us inside a character's heart. I think it's one reason why we turn to fiction, is to know a character maybe as well as we know ourselves, or in some cases even better than we know ourselves. Know a character more intimately than we can know maybe even the people in our lives. This is what fiction can offer us, and it's one of its most rewarding aspects. And so what I wanted to do is somehow render the experience of Lily. I felt that she was a footnote in history, if even that, when I first encountered her. Certainly some activists and academics knew of her, but she wasn't widely known, and I don't think, I hadn't seen anything that had really tried to ponder this question of who was she? What was it like to be her? What was her internal life like? What she did write at the end of her life didn't answer those questions in a satisfying way for me. And so I felt that fiction was a place that I could go in and begin to answer those questions. Now, that sounds incredibly presumptuous of me. Well, writers can be presumptuous. But one of the reasons why I felt that that was possible and I wanted to do it was because we had a really interesting body of evidence about her life that is quite unusual. And what I'm talking about are paintings. And her wife painted her many, many times, over and over. These paintings exist. And in many ways, this is how Lily entered the world, through these paintings. And they render her as she wanted to be seen. They were statements of who she wanted to be, and they were her spouse was helping her present herself to the world. And these paintings, by looking at them and considering what they are, which is a woman who was assigned male at birth, lived as a man named Einar, married a woman. That woman thought her spouse was her husband, named Einar. And then something changed. And these paintings show this. And they show the intimacy that must have existed between these two people and the love and the acceptance. To do an oil portrait of somebody would take hours, days, weeks, months. Lily posing and saying, this is who I am. This is who I want to be. This is how I want the world to see me. And in the case of Gerda, as she's called in the movie, she's saying, I see you, and I accept you, and I love you, and I want the world to see you as you want to be seen. So these paintings illuminated so much about their relationship. And yet they're not words. And I felt there was a quality to the paintings that I could try to bring into the novel and bring into their story and their relationship. And even in maybe the mood of the prose and the book itself. And so this is one reason why I felt fiction would allow that. And was a space that I could go into. And the last thing I want to say about this is, I recognized fairly early on that this is obviously this is a story about identity, and that I saw, but I recognized very early on that it was also a love story, and it was a story about acceptance, and it was a story with this fundamental question of, what do you do when the person you love changes? Everybody is changing. Everybody is evolving. Every relationship evolves. Every person within a relationship will evolve. Those two people will evolve together, but in different ways. There are many variations of this. But this question of what do you do when there's a fundamental change? Does love have limits? Is there a point at which you stop loving somebody? Is there one change that's one change too many? These are big questions that open up a lot for me. They opened a lot for me to write The Danish Girl. And I felt that the way to do that was through fiction. I didn't find the satisfactory answers. Not that that what exists isn't important, and it is. It was important to me, and it's important to anyone who wants to know about Lily. But there was something else. And then maybe I can say one more thing on this. And it has to do with an email I got from a transgender woman from Europe. And she wrote me saying what the book and then the movie meant to her, and that she felt that the way Lily had expressed herself at the end of her life, what sort of denied her own complexity, and that she sometimes acted somewhat girlishly or like an adolescent as she tested out her new identity, and this makes sense, but also this woman who was writing me felt that kind of what we had from the historical record did not reflect the complexity that she must have had in order to go down this path, to do something that had never been done. And she felt that in the letter, in this email, that the book and that this characterization of Lily kind of gave her back the complexity. And I was incredibly moved by this email because that was one of my primary goals.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up, David Ebershoff talks about his most recent novel, The 19th Wife.
Listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton, founder of the year-long book festival, which is held in the historic City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. Let's return to David Griffith's conversation with David Ebershoff.
There's a famous portrait that Picasso attempted to paint of Gertrude Stein, the poet Gertrude Stein. Mm-hmm. It's a very strange portrait because he felt that he couldn't capture her.
Right.
And her face is very kind of pancaked and just very, it's a very strange portrait, and I'm wondering about the ways in which you've taken source material and then created a portrait from that. As you're saying, portraiture is an act of interpretation. I'm not painting exactly what's there.
Yeah.
I'm painting, in some cases, how that person wants to be seen.
Yeah.
As you're saying.
Yeah. Well, that's what artists do. We render. That's what writers do. Painters, sculptors, poets, and. What we love about Monet's haystacks isn't because they are literal representation of haystacks. What we love is the rendering of the haystacks, the way of seeing the haystacks, the variations of way of seeing the haystacks. Monet shows us in those haystacks that one artist doesn't see the same thing the same way. It depends on the day, the time, and what he's thinking and what he's experienced. And this is what artists do. They create a new reality. They see something that doesn't yet exist and they bring it to life. And so this was an incredibly important idea in terms of like thinking about Lily. One really interesting fact about her life is when she lived as Einar Wegener, she had, as Einar, a very successful career as a painter. And then when Lily transitioned and was living as Lily, Lily said, "I don't paint. That belonged to Einar." This is something that she insisted. This is unusual. It's unexpected. There's no reason that she couldn't paint, of course, but there was some psychological border that she had to draw between her past and her present, and this was very important to her. And so she said she never painted, and she wasn't an artist. She insisted she was not an artist. This is a case of where I think the lady doth protest too much, because I feel like she was an artist, and her greatest creation was herself.
Yeah, I'm wondering about this idea of rendering and the way that this is what artists do. And now that we're on art history, to stay one more question.
Yeah.
I ran across the other day this wonderful quote by Degas, where Degas was talking about, you know, artists don't just represent the thing itself, right? But and tell us what to see, but how to see. And I thought maybe if you could speak to the importance, maybe to other people that you've talked to, about how the Danish Girl might teach us how to see people who are in these difficult, life-altering, you know, forks in the road.
Yeah.
Whether to transition or not, or what exactly is it that I'm going through, or what that I'm feeling. Not that every novel has to be pedagogical and teach us about how to live, but nonetheless, I think that we look to them so often for that. I don't know if you could speak to that.
Well, if I can disagree with Degas, that's really presumptuous. I certainly don't write thinking I'm going to show anyone how to see anything. That it feels presumptuous. What we do is show a way of seeing, one way of seeing, or another way of putting it, how I see, or how this character sees, or how this set of characters see. But what I love about a good book is it leaves me it doesn't answer the questions, it poses the questions. It allows me space to think these things through. It gives me enough tools and stories and facts and ideas to think them through. And so what I was thinking with The Danish Girl, and what I feel is important to say, is that this is Lily's story. I did my best to represent an emotional truth to her story. But it is her story, and it can't, by the very nature of that statement, cannot represent what it means to be transgender in all experiences. And that's why every time we encounter a new story, whether it's Transparent or the movie Tangerine, or the character on Orange is the New Black, we see different variations of what it means to be transgender, and there are infinite more. And so what these are saying are not how to see that experience, but a rich way to see these experiences, and by adding them up, they add to something bigger and more complex. The other part of what you're saying is, I do believe that another reason we read fiction is to just that old advice of step into somebody else's shoes, see the world through somebody else's eyes, and anybody with curiosity, we enjoy that experience. And when we do that, we realize that their shoes are not so different than my shoes, and their eyes are not so different from mine. Certainly there are differences, but there are probably many more similarities. And so with The Danish Girl and a character like Lily, what I perhaps hope, but I didn't think this when I was writing it, and I'll tell you why in a second, but perhaps people can go on her journey and understand why she wanted to transition, why she needed to transition, and why she was not herself until she became herself. And that is something that perhaps the story can shed light on in terms of the larger issues that are being discussed today. And certainly, I hope the movie did that. I believe it did. But I also feel it's really important when I'm writing it, not to think in these terms, because then I'll become programmatic and I'll become aware of a lesson I'm trying to pass on, and that would become very boring, and you would find me preachy and annoying, and sure. And you'd put down the book.
Right. Well, it's the old, and I don't think they've ever nailed down who said it. Sometimes they say, W.C. Fields, and sometimes they say David Selznick, and sometimes they say Mel Brooks, but if you want to send a message, use Western Union, right? This idea that we shouldn't set out with the intent of sending a message, you know, through art, but that will emerge, you know, somehow through the work.
Yeah, and for me, I actually don't fully understand what the book is until I've written it. And so therefore I'm not even in a position to send a coherent message. I really write from character and story and language. You know, one sentence after the other, try to build a scene, build a chapter. My character, these two characters, they leave Denmark, they arrive in Paris, they're new to the city, what would they do? That kind of, I break it down to those. And if I were thinking about message, I would lose myself even before I lost my readers.
Sure. Right. You don't want to play puppet master.
No.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Because nobody likes being the puppet.
This is true.
Yeah, this is true. Yeah.
Well, there's the old, you know, Faulkner quote about, you know, after a while, he'd have to run to keep up with his characters. That if you had created them fully enough, that they would take off, you know, on their own.
Yeah, that's true.
I thought maybe just to switch gears a little bit, I know that, you know, you've had a long career, successful career as an editor. And I wondered if you would talk about how your experiences as an editor have helped you along your path as a writer. Are you able to think like an editor, or is that a brain that gets turned off when you're writing? Because these are two different, you know, aspects of the publishing
process. I was really lucky to work at Random House for 20 years, and I started as a summer intern and somehow managed to put together a career there as a book editor and work with writers that I really admired on books that I love. And what I could see is different writers doing different things on the page and observe that. And for me, one of the things that I took away was that the moment when I was most excited about reading a draft of a manuscript and seeing something for the first time was when I saw writers taking risks. When a writer would try something that he or she had not done in his or her career or even within the context of that book, a new way of telling the story, a new voice, mashing together two stories that shouldn't be together, writing. I edited a book by the British writer David Mitchell called Cloud Atlas, an amazing book, and this book is set in the past, the present, and future. And it set past, present, future, and then it comes back from the future to the present to the past. And it's just, it shouldn't work, but it does, and it's a masterpiece. So what I saw is seeing these writers take risks, and I also saw, so I saw how excited I would get as a reader, and then I saw other readers get excited about these risks, and then I saw those books often find different kinds of success because of those risks. I felt that this was one of the most important lessons that I took from being an editor. What I also saw as being an editor, and I tried to encourage it with my writers, is take your risks. If it doesn't pay off, we can fix it. I'm here to say, you know, maybe this character that kind of doesn't fit in the story, we're right, he doesn't fit in the story, so let's take him out. But I would prefer to see a manuscript that's taking risks and maybe pull back on a few that don't totally land than something that's not taking any risks. And so I think for me, that was one of the greatest lessons. And it probably applied to the Danish girl in the story itself when I wasn't sure about the who would want to read the story and then answer the question that I would. And then in my last book, The 19th Wife, which is about polygamy in America, it is a mashup in that it is a historical novel set in the 19th century, and woven through that historical novel is a murder mystery set in present-day southern Utah. And I thought that would be really fun to try to combine these two genres, one that I had worked in, historical fiction, and murder mystery, one I had never written, but had read some, and see if I can somehow make these stories connect through theme and language and style. And it was something that I had no idea if I could pull off. And but it was fun trying.
I'm glad you brought that up. I mean, I enjoyed The 19th Wife just immensely.
Thank you.
I was riveted by it. And I wanted to ask you a question about, you mentioned stories that shouldn't work together, working together. So you've invented a memoir, although a memoir did exist, of Brigham Young's 19th wife, Anna Eliza Young.
Young, correct?
And that runs parallel to the story of Jordan Scott, who's a young man who has been kind of booted out of this community of Mormons who still practice polygamy.
Yeah, they're fundamentalists, and they're the polygamists that you might see in Sister Wives or Warren Jeffs' story in their present day Southern Utah. They're not Mormons. Their ancestors broke from the Mormon Church over the question of polygamy, and they practice polygamy today, often in secret or in isolation. And Jordan is a son of that world, and he's kicked out of that world for not believing, and that's the murder mystery woven. When that story starts, he's living in California. He's been outside of this world for a few years. He's a young man in his early 20s, and he reads online that his father, who was a polygamist, has been murdered. And his mother, who was his father's 19th wife, has been accused of murdering him. And so this draws Jordan back into the world. And that's what you get sort of drawn into, I hope, in the book. And just as you kind of get settled into this story, you turn the page and you are in 19th century America, and you're reading about a whole different set of people in a different part of the country and a different style. And the reader has to sort of figure out how these go together. And what I had to do is figure out how to not just lay them together side by side because they're both about polygamy, but actually have their plots intersect. And there is an act of faith when you write fiction, because I didn't know how they were going to intersect, but I was just writing toward the, I saw it sort of like at 75-80% into the book, pieces of the two stories would begin to ping off of each other and allow the reader to see how the two plots twist together. And I envisioned this happening, although I had no idea how it was gonna happen. And I just really hoped that I could pull it off. And then when I got there, then as you said with Faulkner, the characters kind of told me what was happening and how that would come together.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up, David Ebershoff reads from his novel, The Danish Girl.
You're listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Let's return to David Griffith's conversation with David Ebershoff.
It's a fascinating novel. I mean, you begin with, and we were talking about this in the green room before, you begin with three epigraphs, which I mean, already know. I loved it. The more epigraphs, the better, as far as I'm concerned. Moby Dick has, you know, like 10 pages.
Pages.
But you start with this quote from St. Augustine, which is, faith is to believe what you do not see. The reward of this faith is to see what you believe. And then the next quote is from Arthur Conan Doyle talking about the science of deduction in Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah.
And it really put me in a couple different headspaces. One was there's a Russian theorist, this guy named Todorov, who wrote a lot of books about literary theory. And one of the things he said is that the detective novel is really fascinating because you have two stories. You have the story of the crime, mm-hmm. and then you have the story of the detection, going after the killer. And in this case, Jordan Scott, who's the detective.
He's the amateur detective.
Right?
Yeah.
He's going after, trying to exonerate his mother, but also trying to understand how she can believe these things.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? How could anyone believe these things? And I think we live in a world now where we have many, many people who grew up in a certain faith tradition or churched in a certain way, and then perhaps have left that or fallen away from that in some ways, some people might say. But there's still that lens. There's still that early kind of training in some ways of seeing the world in that way. Mm-hmm. Could you maybe describe what Jordan Scott, how he's seeing the world, and what kind of detective is he as a result of this, this early childhood?
Well, he's been rejected by his family and the world he came from because of faith. And so he's a defiant young man, and so he has this attitude of, if you're going to reject me, I'm going to reject you even more forcefully. I want nothing to do with this world. You guys are crazy. I don't believe anything you say. This is where he starts at the beginning of the book, but he has to go back in to try to exonerate his mother. He has, and his mother was one of the people who rejected him and pushed him out because that's what her church told him to do, told her to do. And he goes back. He has a feeling that she didn't commit this crime, and he wants to see if he can somehow prove that. The other thing that a detective novel does is it takes you into a world, and because an investigator, whether professional or amateur, has to encounter a lot of different kinds of people. Think about mystery novels that you read when something is being solved. The detective will meet a cross-section of the world, from the most powerful to the least, young, the old, the rich, the not rich. It shows you a society. And I was really fascinated about these closed worlds of polygamy, as many people are, because anything that's closed, we want to see what's inside. And so I figured that somebody who's trying to solve a crime within that world would be able to move around it. And so what Jordan is doing is moving around this world, talking to different people, gathering facts, and meanwhile taking the reader through that world. I did that by interviewing some women who had come from a world like this and who had come from one of these large families with many, many sister wives and dozens of children, and really lived outside of what we sort of might think of as American society today. They did their best to remove themselves from it. And I interviewed some women who had left that, and then they gave me a lot of time to really describe what the world they had been born into, raised, married into, and left. And I wanted to know details of sort of what's it like inside these houses? What if you have 45 kids in a house, what is dinner like? What's the bathroom situation like? And you've seen how the girls and women wear their hair long, and I said, what about the sinks and the bathtubs? And I wanted to know these details because that's what books give us. We wanted, I knew I was sort of setting up a promise to the reader that I would take you inside. And so I needed to first take myself inside to describe this. And it wasn't just prurient interest. It was about understanding the experience of being a child of polygamy. What does it mean if your father has multiple wives and you have dozens of siblings, and your father, no matter how good of a father he wants to be, what does it mean if he has to divide his attention among 40? I wanted to explore that experience. And so I felt I really wanted to render it as vividly as possible. So that's the other thing that the detective gets to do, and then what we get to do as readers to see. But the best, the books, I think the crime books or detective fiction that I love the most have something else going on, as what you're saying, and the character isn't just solving a crime, but is going on his own journey or her journey. And in this case, Jordan is coming to terms with faith, where at the beginning of the book, he just really rejects the idea of faith. And then by the end of the book, it's not that he regains that particular faith, but he begins to understand the role of faith in many people's lives, and that it is significant and profound and complex and individual. And he begins to grow up and think about what this is. The other character in the 19th wife, the 19th century plural wife, she says in the book, faith is a mystery, elusive to many and never easy to explain. And then from there, that's I think on the first page of the book, and then from there I write for 500 pages trying to explain what faith perhaps means to different people in different settings, and why it's important, and why it's rich, and why it can be dangerous, and why it can be liberating, and why it can be confining. And that's really what the 19th wife is trying to do. Yes, it's about polygamy in America, but it's really trying to explore those questions of faith and how they shape who we are. And even if you grew up in a faithful household or didn't, it's about this idea of values. And what I believe, I would think everybody in this room has experienced something along these lines, and that as you grow up, you begin to, first you get your family's values and you probably just absorb them without questioning them. And then as you grow up, you begin to evaluate them and use your own thinking and heart to think about what is the values that you have inherited and the faith that you've inherited. And you might accept it wholly, or you might reject it wholly, but what probably most people do is begin to sort of weigh certain elements of that remain important to them, and then certain aspects that they want to shed. And that is part of what we do as we grow up and become ourselves, is sort of rejigger those values to fit ourselves and to our own lives. And it doesn't mean you're turning your back on your family or your parents or even your church, but it does mean that you're becoming your own person. And that's really what Jordan is doing and the other character, Annalisa, is doing. And in many ways, this is also what Lily Elbe is doing in The Danish Girl. She's been told, this is who you are, and then her story is to say, I've actually asked myself who I am, and I believe I'm someone else, and I'm now going to tell you who you are. And the most important person in my life, my wife, she's going to come along for this journey.
Yeah. Well, that's so wonderful to bring it all the way full circle. I think at this point we'll have you read a bit.
Okay.
And then we'll open up questions.
Don't worry, I'm not going to read for too long.
From the audience.
I'm going to just read just the first page of The Danish Girl. And it's Copenhagen, and it's 1925. His wife knew first. Do me a small favor, Greta called from the bedroom that first afternoon. Just help me with something for a little bit. Of course, Einar said, his eyes on the canvas, anything at all. The day was cool, the chill blowing in from the Baltic. They were in their apartment in the widow house, Einar small and not yet 35, painting from memory a winter scene of the Kattegat Sea. The black water was white-capped and cruel, the grave of hundreds of fishermen returning to Copenhagen with their salted catch. The neighbor below was a sailor, a man with a bullet-shaped head who cursed his wife. When Einar painted the gray curl of each wave, he imagined the sailor drowning, a desperate hand raised. his potato vodka voice still calling his wife a port whore. It was how Einar knew just how dark to mix his paints. Gray enough to swallow a man like that, to fold over like batter, his sinking growl. "I'll be out in a minute," said Greta, younger than her husband and handsome with a wide, flat face. "Then we can start." In this way as well, Einar was different from his wife. He painted the land and the sea, small rectangles lit by June's angled light or dimmed by the dull January sun. Greta painted portraits, often to full scale, of mildly important people with pink lips and shine in the grain of their hair. Today was to have been Anna Fonsmark, mezzo-soprano from the Royal Danish Opera. Managing directors and industry titans commissioned Greta to paint portraits that hung in offices above a filing cabinet or along a corridor nicked by a worker's cart. Greta appeared in the doorframe. "You sure you won't mind stopping for a bit to help me out?" she said, her hair pulled back. "I wouldn't have asked if it weren't important. It's just that Anna's canceled again. So would you mind trying on her stockings?" Greta asked. "And her shoes?" "Thank you very much." Thank you. Thanks, Dave. Thank you.
So now we'll open it up for questions from the audience. And I think there are people with mics circulating in the balcony also at the back.
And don't be shy. Yes.
Hello.
Hi.
You wrote Danish Girl in the year 2000. Could you write it today, and would it be any different?
That's a good question. It was my, as I said, it was my first book. It came out in 2000. The world is different. When I made that trip to Copenhagen that I was describing, and I went to the Royal Academy that I was telling you about, that was in 1997. And to put it sort of in context, the year before, in 1996, Congress had passed DOMA, and that was the political environment for gay Americans at the time. Transgender rights were even further removed from the political conversation, and how people were thinking about equal rights for LGBT people was very different than it is today. I made that trip, I went to that building, then fast forward to 2015, about 13 months ago, I was back in that very same building that I was describing, and this is the same building where they had been when they were young artists. But in this moment, it was a different context, and I was with the film crew for The Danish Girl, and lots of guys running around with equipment, and there were cables and lights, and the producers, the screenwriter, the director, movie stars. And everyone was there to tell the story of Lily Elbe. And I had felt so alone when I made that first journey, and now all these people were working to tell the story. And so that was a sort of a sign of progress, of what had changed. Another really amazing piece of it that had changed was when we were on set, the American ambassador to Denmark came to visit to pay his respects to the production, to tell us how important he felt the story was. If we needed any help, the embassy was there. This in and of itself, I found remarkable, that the American government was recognizing the story and validating it, and the ambassador had made this effort to express that in person. The other thing that I couldn't really wrap my mind around was that our ambassador in Copenhagen lives in the ambassador's residence with his husband. The world has changed. But it hasn't changed enough. Yes, the world has changed. And it's important to note that progress while also noting how much there is left to achieve and what transgender individuals continue to face today. It's really, one of the things that's really moving about the movie is Lily's struggle to find medical care. Adequate, empathetic medical care is not all that different from what a lot of transgender individuals experience today. This is sort of what I wanted to say before directly answering your question, if you will. Which I actually can't fully answer, this idea of what book would I write today versus what I wrote then. It would be a different book because I'm the same person, but I'm a different person. I am the same writer, but I'm a different writer. And I would think about it from the way I think of stories today versus what I thought then. How it would be different, I probably can't fully articulate. The other piece of it certainly would be the political aspect. And I fear that if I were to write it today, I might have burdened myself with this idea of message and representation, which is so important, but can sink a work of art, as I was saying earlier. And if I had gone into it thinking of Lily as representing something rather than Lily as Lily, Lily as a human being, Lily as an experience that needs to be rendered with complexity, I might have sort of over-programmed it and made it be a lesson and therefore probably wouldn't have flattened. I might have been tempted by that today.
So, David, thank you so much. Oh, I have totally enjoyed these past 2 days, but we're out of time, and I thank all of you for coming out today.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you.
That was David Ebershoff talking with David Griffith. Ebershoff's latest book is The 19th Wife. Support for the National Writers Series comes from Jonathan and Marissa Wege, supporting good things that need to happen now. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org and listen to past programs at interlockinpublicradio.org. For Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Linnea Melkerich.